Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Scott Reich of Crime Talk, and today we are bringing you a Saturday edition. We have a conversation with Ann Howard. She is the author who wrote His Garden, Conversations with a Serial Killer. This was her book regarding her interviews with William Devin Howell. Now, Ms. Howard's book is the book that inspired Cheryl Lynn Cadel to write Letters from Chris. Well, with our interview here today, we have new information and new developments on what we've coined Cadelgate, and I think you'll find it interesting. Ann Howard's book sounds like a great read. I'm taking it with me on Christmas vacation, and she's working on a new book as well that sounds absolutely fascinating. Let's talk about it. Good morning. Today we have attorney and author Ann Howard with us. And first of all, thank you for joining us on a Saturday morning. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So, Ann, why don't you give me a quick little bio of what you do, how'd you get into writing, and how did you come about writing His Garden?
Okay, sure. Well, Scott, I've always been a writer. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I wrote short stories and kept journals. And I'm a little embarrassed to say that I wrote a historical romance in my 20s when my kids were babies before I went to law school. Unfortunately, that book is still up on Amazon beside my current true crime book. I'm a little embarrassed about that. But, you know, I decided at the age of 30 to go to law school when my kids were little. And so really for the last 20 years, I've been very busy practicing law. And, you know, I've always been a voracious true crime reader ever since I was a teenager. I just couldn't get enough of this stuff. I don't know why I never thought to write true crime until just a few years ago. But there were some serial murders in my town where I live now in Connecticut that I was investigating, and I wrote a blog about serial murders in Connecticut. And while I was writing that blog investigating those unsolved serial murders, lo and behold, in my newsfeed, I started coming across these other serial murders that were happening in New Britain, Connecticut, and the killer had yet to be found. So I became quite intrigued, and I started to blog about those serial murders. And in May of 2015, the chief state attorney, Kevin Kane, here in Connecticut, announced in a televised news conference that they finally had a person of interest in those New Britain serial murders. Seven bodies had been found behind a strip mall. It seems like a crazy place to have a burial ground because it was in a very populated commercial district, but in many ways it was quite ingenious for the serial killer that I wrote this book, His Garden, Conversations with a Serial Killer, about to put the bodies there because there are no trespassing signs. The 15 acres of forest is owned by the state and it's inaccessible to the public. So it was really quite crafty of him to put the bodies there. When I found out that they had a person of interest in the New Britain serial murders, I contacted the man, William Devin Howell, who had been charged with the remaining six of the seven murders. He was in prison at the time. And I asked him if he was okay with me writing a book about him and about the crimes that he was alleged to have committed. And much to my surprise, he said, sure. Amen. So from there, it was just hundreds of pages of written correspondence that I received from him over 3 years, monthly prison visits, recorded phone calls, and ultimately it culminated in him confessing all of the crimes in great detail exclusively to me.
Wow. And was he ultimately prosecuted for all of those crimes?
Yes, he most certainly was. He got, at the time we met, Scott, he was serving a 15-year sentence for one of the murders. They had not, when they convicted him in 2007 for that murder, they had not found the body yet of the victim. but there was a droplet of her blood in his van, which he infamously called the murder mobile. And based on that single drop of blood, along with the testimony of this woman's boyfriend stating, William Devin Howe was the last person that I saw with my girlfriend driving off with her, that was enough for him to agree to take an Alford plea, which, as you know, says, I'm not conceding that I'm guilty, but I am conceding that the prosecution could feasibly have enough evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So when we first got in contact in 2015, the six remaining murder charges were all pending and trial was pending. It was out there in the distant future.
Sure.
And obviously his lawyers wanted to talk to me right away.
I'm sure.
Because they didn't want their client talking to an author. They didn't want him sabotaging his case. But they were actually very wonderful to work with. I really got to know his defense counsel over the course of the next 3 years. We kept in touch by phone and email. And I was very careful to not disclose anything publicly at that time that could in any way interfere with the case that was on the horizon. So he did end up getting 60 years for each victim, totaling 360 years. He did plead guilty ultimately and was sentenced to 360 years.
Wow. Well, yeah. Let me ask you this. What kind of draws you to this true crime genre of writing, and what interests you about it? I mean, I know so many people are fascinated about it. I do it on a daily basis, and mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by
it. I know, yeah.
I mean, Mr. Howe, for example, was he what you thought you were going to, you know, the person you were going to meet and thinking, oh, this person may be a potential serial killer? I've, you know, like, what is a murderer? What does a serial killer look like? You know?
Yeah. You know, I think you get to a good point that I think what interests most of us about true crime is human psychology. And, you know, it's just a Pandora's box. Where you're trying to analyze, is this a genetic issue? Is this a neurological bad brain wiring? Was it, you know, the nature versus nurture debate? Was it something that happened in his childhood, or was he simply born that way? So I think that for me is what draws me to true crime, is just to try to understand what can make human beings behave in such deviant and violent ways. And I will say that from the first moment I met him, he defied all of my expectations. And I think that's because, you know, we hang on to these stereotypes of serial killers based on maybe Ted Bundy. So we think everyone's going to be like Ted Bundy, or everyone's like Jeffrey Dahmer. But each serial killer is as unique as the day is long, you know?
Absolutely.
And right. And in his case, he presented in our first prison visit as just an extremely friendly, easygoing, gregarious guy. He also, during that visit, would just weep. He cried profusely for the entire hour and a half that we were talking. Interestingly, though, he wasn't crying about the victims. He wasn't crying about the victims' families.
Yeah.
He was crying about kind of self-pitying things about his own past. You know, how the mother of his children left him, and kind of woe is me, and his girlfriend died. And so I think there are elements of narcissism there. He is a sociopath. Basically, in my book, I came to the conclusion, even though I'm an attorney, I'm not a psychiatrist, but if I could render a diagnosis as a layperson, I would say he has a paraphilia, which is basically a sexual sadism where he is neurologically aroused by seeing somebody else suffer at his hands. So, and of course, he's also a sociopath. I think that in a nutshell is what draws most of us to our interest in true crime, and also spiritual aspects. You know, I mean, Do we have souls? What happens to these people when they die? You know, do they go to hell? Is there any kind of punishment beyond this lifetime? Questions like that are very intriguing to me as well.
I think you nailed it right there. I mean, it's what makes these people think, what brought them to do what they've done or allegedly have done. And I've represented lots and lots of people over the years that have been charged with murder. And you know, many of them have multiple victims, and yet they can be like the nicest guy ever, and if you had met them on the street, you would never have thought of them as someone who has killed multiple people. It's very intriguing to me. What, like I said, what does a murderer look like? It's not like you can say, oh yeah, that's the guy that's going to do it. It's
I know.
what's inside, and you can't see that always.
Right. And he had a lawn care business. Ironically, sadly, he chose his victims based on his lawn care schedule. So if he didn't have to go to work the next morning, he was free to pick up a drug addicted prostitute and do his thing with her, multiple rapes and holding her in captivity and whatnot in the back of his van before strangling them. So it was a very random decision on regarding who he would choose as a victim. But the people who I've talked to who actually hired him to mow their lawns, I had one older woman come to a book event and say, he was just the friendliest, nicest guy. And my husband and I would have him into our house. We would make him a sandwich and give him a soda. When he drove up to our neighborhood to mow all the lawns in his van, all the children would come running out in the summer to say hi to him. He was like the Pied Piper, she said. And so I know I'm not alone because sometimes people have said he duped you, but even his lawyers have said to me, we're just confounded. We can't believe that this man that we have gotten to know and who we genuinely like did such heinous acts.
Yeah, and did he ever explain, why the randomness? Why not the couple that invites him in for coffee because you were nice to him? Or like you said, and I think that's probably some of the scariest cases I've ever had, where literally somebody will say, I'm on the bus, and literally he sees somebody getting out of the car, and he pulls a little bus string, and he's like, I pick you. And that's the scary part of it. Did he ever explain how we came about that?
Yeah, and I go into that in great detail in the book. It's the oddest thing. But he had this unbridled hatred for drug addicted prostitutes. And, in a blog post I subsequently wrote about it, I compare it to it's almost like how Nazis during, World War II would see the Jewish victims in the concentration camps as not being human beings. So he had this bifurcated kind of morality where, if you were a woman, any woman who was not a drug addicted prostitute, okay, then you were safe. But he targeted drug addicted prostitutes and just despised them. He told me, fantasizing about raping them in his 20s when he was in prison. And he was so angry because he was getting repeatedly incarcerated simply for driving without a license, because he had a DUI and he kept driving without a license. And before you knew it, he was a habitual offender and he was serving longer sentences than a guy that would have robbed a bank. And he felt like a victim. He was getting very angry at the system. He was getting very angry at the mother of his children who had left him for another man and would never let him see the children. And I think he was just feeling like a social failure. He had no money, he had no education, he had no status in the society. And so he channeled all of that rage onto these poor women that he raped and killed.
Did he ever say, I mean, obviously he had some issues, but did he have a bad experience, or did this somehow relate to his wife that had left him in regards to, prostitute drug addiction? Was there something about that that
I think we kind of discovered as we were writing the book, at one point he said to me, you know, I think you've really come to some right conclusions that I never realized before, that I was directing a lot of my rage at this woman who was mother of his children, at these women. They were just easy targets. But beyond them being easy prey, no, I don't think there was anything more personal to it. But you know, Scott, as you know, serial killers often pick prostitutes. I mean, starting with Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, nobody cares. Nobody cares if they're gone.
There you go. And moreover, you know, these women are putting themselves into really precarious, high risk situations. If you go on to my Serial Murders in Connecticut blog site, I have a lot of crime scene photos, and there are photos of this van that he drove around. And nobody in their right mind would walk into that van in the middle of the night, except if you are a drug addicted prostitute and desperate for your next fix.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, you brought that up, your blog site. What's the link, or what's the address to
you
your
know,
blog site?
I wish I could give it to you, because it's a strange link that I start. It's like RT8 murders or something like that, because at first I started it based on these unsolved Route 8 murders. So what I would advise people to do is do an online search for Serial Murders in Connecticut blog, and it will come up right away. And also I encourage people to go to the icon to like the Serial Murders in Connecticut Facebook page. We have almost 3,000 followers, and I write about all sorts of solved and unsolved murders in the Nutmeg State in that Facebook page.
All right. Well, we will try to find those links and put them here, so anyone that watches this video can find them as well and go check it out. So,
thank you.
Let's talk. I mean, your book sounds fascinating, and as I told you as we were kind of talking, I have ordered it, and hopefully it arrives before I depart. It's supposed to come today, and I'll be taking it with me on my vacation. But let's talk about how we met. We hadn't spoken or met until, I guess, earlier this week. Why don't you tell us how it is that we came about?
Okay. Well, you know, it came to my attention that you had Sherilyn Cadle, the author of Letters from Christopher, on your show. And somebody emailed me about a week and a half ago and sent me a link. It was to a YouTube video by a woman named Kimberly, a YouTuber out there. And she had evidently uncovered that sections of my book, His Garden, Conversations with a Serial Killer, had been plagiarized by Sherilyn Cadle in this book about Chris Watts, Letters from Christopher. So I thought I'd contact you about the situation and get some exposure about it. Things have moved in really fast motion since I first contacted you, Scott. Okay. And when I talked to you about it, I'd only known about this plagiarism for, I think, a couple of days. I bought the book on Kindle, Letters from Christopher, and I did a side-by-side comparison, which you previously showed on your show, of the plagiarized sections. And I was just overwhelmed that I couldn't believe she clipped and pasted my voice and my words and my thoughts and presented them to the public as if they came from her mind. It really did feel like a direct violation. My publisher agreed. My publisher is Wild Blue Press out of Denver, Colorado.
Okay.
They publish a ton of true crime books, and it's in fact run by two men, one of which is a best-selling true crime author himself, Steve Jackson. So my publisher got in touch with Cadle's attorney. Cadle's attorney, interestingly, he immediately reached out to me without my contacting him. And I think he was quite concerned with it as well. So what happened was, just a few days ago, my publisher issued a letter of demand to Cadle and her attorney, requesting a few different things to remedy this legal violation. The first is that Cadle withdraw her book from all sales outlets, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble. That it no longer be available on Kindle. It can no longer be printed by the self-publishing company that she had produced this book, Dorrance Publishing. And just last night, we got news from her attorney that she will agree to that term. Sherilyn Cadle, yes, excellent. She is taking the book off the market. She is notifying all of these sales outlets online immediately, and Dorrance will stop printing the book. So that's the most important thing. The second term we had was that she issue a public apology on any of her social media sites, and she has agreed to do that. Unfortunately, I think she's taken down most of her social media sites right now because she's been getting a lot of attack about this. But if I can get hold of that letter of apology once she issues it, she's informally apologized to me. But once I get that formal letter, I would like to post it on a few sites.
Well, if you get it, let me know, and we will certainly put it up as well, because you know how it is. Writing is not easy. Obviously, I mean, your book took a long time to do, and as an attorney, people always ask as an attorney, you know, what's your job like? Well, remember in high school they told you to do that 10-page report, and you think, I'll be able to knock this thing out, but it's a lot more difficult than it, and it always takes longer than you thought it would, particularly when you're trying to write something very well and logical and coherent. So if somebody were to take your work and just cut and paste it as your own, I mean, it's offensive because
it is.
Writing is hard.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I liken writing true crime to writing a doctoral thesis. You know, the book I'm writing right now is about false confessions. And just yesterday, I spent the entire day citing my sources in the bibliography section for the first 120 pages of the book. So the research I've done is literally, you know, like, That much, including law review articles, articles from local papers. I've got well over 500 pages of investigative reports. So you have to always cite your sources. And if you're going to include someone else's writing, you're going to attribute it to them. It's not enough just to rearrange the words. You still have to attribute that thought process to that person. So there really are no shortcuts to writing true crime. And the big challenge is then to make it page turning, you know, because you don't want it to read like a doctoral thesis. You want to read it to read like a John Grisham book, you know?
Exactly.
But that, you bring up an interesting point, though, that Cadle in her book does not have one footnote, not one footnote. She does not have a bibliography section. She does not cite one source. Now that, I mean, I know she put clipped and pasted discovery in her book, but there's a full paragraph taken from the Washington Post in her book. No citation. She wrote about a turtle suit, saying what a turtle suit or a Ferguson gown is. And, you know, as most of you know, that's what the prisoners wear if they're suicidal, so they can't hang themselves. And when I read her description, her two-line description of a Ferguson gown turtle suit, I thought, that sounds like it came from Wikipedia. So I Googled turtle suit, and the first thing that came up was the Wikipedia description of what it is, and it was word for word what Cadle clipped and pasted. She had to footnote that. She needed to footnote Wikipedia, which isn't the greatest of sources for true crime writers, but you still are under an obligation to cite all your sources. You can't just clip and paste other people's thoughts and research and then just put it in a book.
Yeah. Well, I feel bad. Obviously, we had Cadle on our show. The publisher had reached out to us, and I'm like, okay. And the content was really kind of a rehash, but I thought, well, this is an interesting story as it relates to Chris Watts. She's one of the few people that had since talked to him. And she purported these letters to be from him, which I have no doubt that they, in fact, were. In fact, I've learned that some people are very upset about that, and there may be other issues related to those in the future. Yeah. But, you know, we put her on and talked to her as to that, but it was very obvious that this was her first book. It wasn't exactly well-written, et cetera, but still had some value there because she had spoken to this Christopher Watts guy, and he was the one that had agreed to speak with her. So I thought it was rather interesting to figure out if there was something that would we could learn that made Chris Watts tick.
Right.
And obviously, right. You know, like all things in life, the truth or a pretty darn close version of it will ultimately come out. And particularly in today's world where everything can be source checked immediately.
Right.
So
exactly.
All right.
And I wanted to mention also, Scott, the other two terms.
Sure, please.
That we have agreed to as part of this demand letter. We requested that all proceeds of the sales of this book, since it came out 3 months ago, be turned over to me because of the plagiarism. And so Cadle claims that she has not received any of the proceeds yet, but when she does, she will turn over all of the proceeds to me, minus expenses incurred by her or Dorrance Publishing in the creation of the manuscript.
Okay.
That gives me a little concern. And I think as an attorney, you can understand why.
Yeah, but suddenly there's going to be a lot of expenses there, I bet, right?
I'm thinking, are we going to get five-star hotels? Are we going to get the brand-new laptop computer she just purchased? Or, I mean, how far are we going to go with this? But at least she agreed to that term. And then finally, she will have the right to republish her book after she removes the infringed excerpts that she took from me. And she will have to do it under a different title. However, my concern is, you just mentioned that it has come to your awareness that there may be other people who are upset with her for using things in the book that they claim she did not have their permission to use. And I'm aware of at least one other author who contacted Amazon with copyright infringement concerns regarding letters from Christopher. So, you know, I would just say, if and when she does want to republish the book after she takes out my sections, I would think any traditional publisher or self-publisher should be a little bit wary of taking on this liability risk, because I think the party's just begun. I mean, I think more things are going to happen, and I don't know if it's something that, you know, maybe they'll say, hey, there's money in it, why not? I don't know, but people should be aware that mine is not the only infraction going on out there.
Understand. Is there a deadline by which she has to make this public apology to you?
We didn't discuss it other than to say, you know, pretty much immediately for everything. And she has to immediately contact her publisher to cease sales. She has to immediately contact Amazon. And then the ball will be in those parties' hands in terms of getting this book down from sales outlets. But I would anticipate that apology will be coming in the next week.
Okay. Well, yeah. Like I said, if you receive it and you'd like to share it with us, we'll be more than happy to post it as well, so that people know that obviously your work had been stolen and under the circumstances. I mean,
I appreciate that.
Someone that, you know, you prepare, you research, you write, collecting all those things. It takes a tremendous amount of time, and to have somebody just cut and paste it, you know, it's kind of obviously frustrating, right. I'm sure.
Right. It really is. Yeah. By the way, you know, if you see me trembling or shaking, I'm not afraid. I'm so cold right now. It's 20 degrees in my house, and I always wear layers. So you get me out. I usually be in my pajamas with a vest on and my winter coat on, because we live in the hills of Connecticut. And I have a blouse on now, and I'm just freezing.
All right.
Oh, my fingers are ice cold.
So you said you're working on another book. When do you think that's maybe out? And obviously, he was talking about False Confessions, which I find absolutely fascinating.
Right. You know, I would expect, we're talking here about the process of writing and how laborious it is. I've got about 140 pages right now. I hope it's going to be about 320 pages. So I think I'll be done by the end of the summer. So it's involving a lot of research because what I'm doing, the tentative title is Coerced: True Stories of False Confessions. And what I'm doing is I'm choosing five different cases of false confessions that the public, for the most part, isn't really aware of. I wanted to choose ones that I didn't want to go into the Norfolk Four, everybody's heard about those, the Central Park Five or whatever. Instead, I wanted to dig up some vintage cases that a lot of people. So the first one, the first story I'm telling, I've already written that. Involves a serial murder case here in Connecticut back in the early 70s, where a schizophrenic man was wrongfully convicted. And you'll see in these false confessions, as you know, that there are really three types of groups that are especially vulnerable to false confessions. The mentally ill or the mentally disabled. Some would argue things like Brendan Dassey and the Making of the Murderer falls into that category.
Sure.
So also the second group would be juveniles for obvious reasons. And the third group, which I find the most fascinating, is people who kill to protect, I'm sorry, people who falsely confess to protect someone that they love. And so I'm also telling the story of Jens Søring, the German diplomat's son, who back in the 80s falsely confessed to murdering his girlfriend's parents. And there's a fabulous documentary about that called Killing for Love that I highly recommend anybody watch. But Jens was recently paroled, just literally about 2 weeks ago, and deported back to Germany. But he got himself into such a mess as an 18-year-old kid. He fell madly in love with a very troubled woman, and she killed her parents, according to Jens. And he took the rap, wrongly thinking that as a German diplomat's son, he would be deported back to Germany and as a juvenile, serve no more than 5 to 10 years. He
Wow.
ended up in a Virginia prison for 33 years. So, yeah, it's fascinating, but it involves so much research.
Did his girlfriend wait for him?
She turned on him almost immediately after he confessed for her. She really duped him. And Elizabeth Haysom was her name, and she ended up getting something like 40 years in prison. But she was paroled on the same day Jens was paroled 2 weeks ago, and she was sent back to Canada where she was born. So
Interesting.
I guess the US doesn't want to deal with them. But I personally strongly believe that Jens was 100% innocent. And I've been in correspondence with him. He's been very helpful turning over legal material to me and opening up to me about his experiences.
Well, that sounds interesting. I wasn't familiar with that particular case, but when you complete your book, let us know and we'll have you back on because that sounds interesting. I've had a couple of cases over the years where it dealt with false confessions and, dealing with experts that can come in and testify about how people were coerced, even to the slightest degree. It's amazing what you can get people to say if you say something the correct way. So it's a
Right.
fascinating subject.
Or if you threaten, the death penalty. I mean,
Yeah.
that's really no different than what was done in the Grand Inquisition, where you're threatened with death, with pain and death, and you'll say anything to get out of that. But what I'm going into a lot in the book too is the Reed technique that detectives are trained to use. And I think the public is in large part quite naive to the fact, or most people don't realize that cops lie all the time during interrogations, and they are allowed to lie about forensic evidence, the DNA, witness statements. They can say, "Look, we found the murder weapon in your home." They can make up any lie they want in order to get you to confess. And if you are a weaker-minded person, a young person, you're terrified, you're sleep deprived, it's amazing what you will say.
I have talked about the Reed interrogation techniques several times on our channel, and a lot of jurisdictions basically aren't allowed to use it. But the problem is so many tens of thousands of detectives have gone through this training,
right?
And this is what they use to get people to confess, like, oh, we know you did it. Your buddy's across the way. He just told you you did it. Why don't you come clean? Yeah. Oh, I think you're a good guy. Maybe something just happened. Yeah. And if you just tell me just a little bit of it, it just flows from there.
Yeah. And I think what's fundamentally so faulty about the Reed technique is it starts off at, you know, step two or three with an assumption of guilt.
Yep.
So, you know, how intellectually honest and accurate is the outcome going to be when the one doing the interrogating has already concluded that you are guilty, and now they will do anything to get you to submit to that conclusion?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, they've formed their conclusion, and now let's go get the facts to back up our conclusion versus, you know, a good detective will simply say, tell me the facts. Let the chips fall where they may, and then we'll go from there. But many of them form the basis of their conclusion based upon false information, and then go get information to support their conclusion, no matter how twisted and disjointed it may be. And people believe, well, he's a police officer. He must be telling the truth.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of jurisdictions now are required to record the confessions and the interrogations, even from start to finish. And that's something I'm such a proponent of, because in this one story I'm telling in my book about the case that took place in the 1970s, as I'm reading through all of the police investigative reports, especially regarding this man's alleged confessions, it's all written down by the detectives, and in the public, or the jury in this case, is expected to take the detectives at their word that what they wrote down was accurate. And we don't have any audio or video of what actually happened. I think it should be federally mandated that all jurisdictions, at the very least, record confessions and interrogations from start to finish.
Yeah, obviously, more and more are starting to, but coincidentally, the FBI doesn't record interviews. They still rely on their 302s. But most people don't know is that when detectives are in there taking their notes and they're writing them down, then they go back and they retype their report.
Yes, they do.
And then they tear up their report, their notes, and destroy them. So if he says, oh, client confess, but the first, 4 hours of deny, deny, deny aren't there, and they leave all that out. And so... Right. You know, attorneys have to ask that all notes be preserved from here on out, because those notes sometimes vary greatly from what the actual report is. And even today in my practice, even though the detective will say this is what he said, go ahead and, refer to the 6-hour video interview for further details. And there's great exculpatory information. I once had a judge tell the district attorney that a detective needs to be prosecuted for what he did, and went to a grand jury, and of course no charges were filed, but the police officer either A, didn't watch the video or didn't recall or seen it, and wrote an affidavit as though what my client had said was completely never mentioned, and it was complete fabrication. And of course when they got that arrest warrant, they should have put that information in. And so police should be doing it better and cleaner than everybody else, and they're fact finders. They're not judges. They need to get the evidence, let the chips fall where it may. Let the prosecutor make their charging decisions, and let a jury make the decisions, but not form the evidence to fit the conclusion they want.
Yeah, and what fascinates me about false confessions is that a confession is considered the gold standard. You know, that if you get that confession as the detective and as the prosecutor, you pretty much have a slam dunk win on your hands. And regardless of the DNA that might contradict that confession, or the fact that the confession doesn't line up with, say, the actual crime scene and how it visibly appeared. But like it or not, juries and judges alike have tremendous belief in a confession, that if you said it, then why on earth would anyone but a crazy person forfeit their liberty and go to jail for the rest of their lives? So it must be true. But again, if you look at all the underlying psychological factors that make people confess, you find out it actually happens a lot more than we think. I think the Innocence Project stat is that in 23% of the wrongful conviction cases that they've had overturned in recent years, those cases involved false convictions, confessions,
Yeah.
where DNA evidence subsequently excluded this person as being the one who did it. So it happens. It's not very common, but it does happen a lot more than we think.
It does happen for sure, and I wasn't aware it was 23% of all of those cases. I know there's a high percentage of false identification issues, but false confessions. A lot of people, like I said, those statements were written before we have videotape today or even recordings. Detectives don't worry about that. And a lot of times I've had clients that had said, "Yeah, I said I did it, but I also said I'll say whatever you want me to say. It won't be the truth, but if you say I did it, then I did it." You know what I mean? It's and they take that out of context. So it's I look forward to hearing about that. It sounds absolutely fascinating. Having done a couple of cases like that where false confessions were an issue, so I really look forward to it. Is there anything else you would like us to know about the Cheryl Cadle incident other than you've made your demands? She's going to take her book out of being published. She's supposed to forfeit all monies to you and make a public apology. Is there anything else, and as far as timelines, you think when this will be resolved, before the first of the year or after?
I think it's now in the hands of Amazon and these online sellers. How quickly are they going to take that book down? And I don't know. I've heard that Amazon is actually pretty quick with this kind of thing. So I would hope that you're going to see it off the market within the next week, hopefully by the new year. But the only other thing that I will say about the Sherrilyn Cadle controversy is that in the first informal apology that she wrote to me about it about a week ago, she said to me that she had never gone to college. And in her words, she had no place writing a book. Well, certainly there are a lot of great authors out there that didn't go to college, right?
Sure.
It happens. It
Sure.
happens. Self-taught people who love to read and write and just didn't get a formal education. But what I do think at the end of the day is I think she was in over her head, and I think the reality in this crazy world of true crime writing, podcasting, YouTubing is that you're going to get a lot of amateurs. You're going to get a lot of people in their mother's basement doing their YouTube videos, and they're talking about complicated legal issues, and they don't know what they're talking about. But you do see a lot of it out there, and you kind of have to separate the wheat from the chaff. That there are the amateurs, and then there are the real writers, the real podcasters, the ones that really know their stuff. So I think she read my book. And she loved my book, she said, and it inspired her. I think it probably inspired her to contact Chris Watts to write a similar type of book. But she got in over her head. And there may be, some character issues too, because it did take kind of a lack of conscience on her part to just clip and paste my words and put it in the book.
It's
So
not. It's not like she just. It was an accident. And, oh, did that just? I mean, she had to consciously
It's
do
not
that.
like George Harrison saying "My Sweet Lord" is was just echoing in his head based on "He's So Fine." it wasn't just kind of like, "Gee, that kind of sounds like what I wrote." It was what I wrote in paragraph form.
Okay. Well, we tried to talk about the facts here, and hopefully the facts will come out about this. And I think the facts are coming out that obviously your work was plagiarized, and hopefully you'll get complete vindication here, is what should happen. And as I stated, I will hopefully get my book today. Amazon tells me that it should be here today. And your book is titled His Garden, Conversations with a Serial Killer, obviously by Ann Howard. So I'll ask Kyle to put a link up to that as well. So if any of our viewers want to click on that and get it for a good read, I look forward to reading it just because of my own personal experience dealing with people that have committed serious crimes. And it always fascinates me as to what makes these people tick and what happened. How did they get here? And there's usually something, just like in your gentleman, that there's one event usually, or a series of a couple of events that made them who they are today and to do what they do. So I look forward to the read. So
thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate you having me on. And I'm really glad I got to know you, and I look forward to further discussions.